Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, this is Susanna Greenberg, host of Book Buzz, the show all about books. Today we have Rich Zarodnik, author of A Black Sail, a Coleridge Taylor mystery, book 3 in the Coleridge Taylor series. It's now available for pre-order, and the series feature the newsman Coleridge Taylor. This book is set in New York City on the eve of the bicentennial in 1976. Rich Zarodnik is an award-winning author. He's been a journalist for over 30 years, working as a reporter and editor in all major media, and now the author of the Coleridge Taylor mystery series. Welcome, Rich. How are you today?
I'm well. Thank you for that very nice introduction. How are you?
I'm terrific. I'm so thrilled to have you here. Your books are wonderful. I should mention Publishers Weekly wrote of the last volume, Drop Dead Punk.
Yeah, that's very exciting.
Taylor, who lives for the big story, makes an appealingly single-minded hero. So critics and readers are loving your books. And again, it's available in October. And just quickly, I'll mention that it will be available from Amazon, BarnesandNoble.com, IndieBound, Smashwords, and in audiobook for you audiobook fans as well. So tell us, Rich, what is the book about?
The book is about, as you said, it starts on the eve of the bicentennial. The Taylor series started in March of 75 with the first book, so I'm with each book skipping to somewhere forward in the 70s that excites me and interests me. And for those that were not alive or don't remember it, the bicentennial was a big deal, 200 years as a country, and in New York the biggest celebrations were held, which included 16 tall ships, ships of sail, and 53 naval vessels. Actually, the naval armada was much larger than the ships of sail. And Taylor has to help cover this at the little wire service he now works for because it's a big deal. He is not a fan of set piece events like this because everybody, 2,700 journalists are covering it, and you really don't get a chance at a scoop or an individual story when that's going on. He's more interested in the woman who was fished out of the New York Harbor when he was out with the Harbor Patrol, kind of getting a feature story ready in advance of the bicentennial. She's fished out of the harbor, which is, one thing that does happen, but she's got bricks of heroin strapped around her waist. And so he is trying to pursue this very strange murder that obviously looks drug-related while the bicentennial is going on and while he is at times forced to cover it, and even at times he's against his will, I think, forced to be amazed by these sailing ships and all the other stuff that's going on.
Beautiful. And now, what inspired you to write about ships of sail? Is this a special interest of yours?
Yeah, when I do these, as I move forward in time, I can look at different events and say, okay, yeah, that would be something I'd like it to be around. That doesn't always have to be true of the books. The first book, really, it didn't have any major event except that the war in Vietnam was about to end. That is, in 1975, the North Vietnamese overran the South Vietnamese. We had left in 73, which is when a lot of people perceived the war to have ended. But, I mean, I kind of glommed onto this idea, the next book was about the near bankruptcy of New York City, and so I was looking into 1976, and there's the bicentennial. And I am not a sailor at all, but I'm a huge fan of Patrick O'Brien's series of naval histories or historical fiction about the Royal Navy, featuring Aubrey and Maturin, the captain and the spy. I, in fact, have read all but three of them. And so I'm fascinated by the boats and the ships. Calling them boats shows how much of an amateur I am. That's a mistake Taylor also makes. I'm fascinated by all the ships, and I saw the opportunity to have them at least in the background of a Taylor book. And it's a time I remember. I lived 2 hours north up the Hudson growing up, so that was why I picked the bicentennial. But I have to be careful because Although I set these in, you know, when something major is going on, Taylor obviously can't play a major role in the big story that's in the background because, like, that's not the history of what happened. But it creates all kinds of opportunities for incidents and things to happen and to be out on the water and all that other stuff.
So it's a blend of history and mystery.
Yeah, correct.
Fiction and nonfiction. And all set in New York of the 70s. What do you think, why are you drawn to this particular era in New York City? What is interesting to you about the 70s in New York?
I wish I could say there was a good giant, you know, reason that pulls me to the 70s. When I sat down with the first idea for the first book, which was a very simple idea. The book's called Last Words, and it's what would happen if a really good police reporter made a big mistake and got demoted to the obituaries desk. And that's all I had. And then I'm sitting down to write it, and I did not want to write a mystery set in the world of nine-second DNA identification, instant facial recognition, cameras everywhere. We can get a picture of anything or video anywhere. Because first, I think some of that, much of that, that has been taught to the audience more by TV than books, but some books also, is really techno sci-fi. It's not actually possible to do what they show as going on in the present day, except because everyone's been taught that's the way it works, you have to play by those rules. And I wanted to play by the rules where, you know, you had to, you know, use legwork to figure out what was going on. You didn't have a cell phone. You had to use pay phones. You know, you had to go get to people and not come up with weird excuses to go get to them, since now everyone has a phone. You know, all these TV series you watch where someone, you know, shows up at someone else's house to talk to them, you wonder, well, why didn't they call? But so I went back in time, you know, and I, you know, you only need to push back into the early 90s, maybe late 80s. And, you know, when I think about it, I think I probably did fall on that period in February, March, April of 75, when a very unloved war, one that had already been forgotten by Americans, was ending because we were in the midst of some similarly unloved wars that were, if not forgotten, not being paid close attention to while, you know, men and women were over there sacrificing. So I think that probably grabbed me a little bit. And, you know, once you do that, you start delving into the period, and the near bankruptcy of New York City has real close parallels to the economic crisis we went through, with, you know, ratings agencies ignoring the problem and keeping New York debt at a AAA rating, and people lying and money disappearing, and if the city had gone down, which was very probable until Ford finally backed down and said he would bail it out, there probably would have been we were in a recession already, a much deeper recession, something like a Great Recession or something like that. So you glom onto things as you move forward at that point.
Mm-hmm. So it's interesting how the lack of the technology made for more legwork and more personal interaction. So that's one appeal, but also maybe the darkness of the times really.
Yeah, no, I got.
More...
I mean, I knew I wasn't going to write about, you know, the disco 70s, obviously, but, you know, the more I delved into it, the more I remembered, if not realized, how dark the 70s were in the city. The Bronx was burning, a famous phrase, but it was burning at about four blocks a week at its worst.
Yeah.
You know, the homicide rate had doubled. The city was about to go bankrupt. All of Central Park was a no-go area. You could be mugged almost anywhere in the city, particularly at night. There was nowhere that was safe. And so I ended up with this Times Square was completely overrun with porn. So I ended up with this hard-boiled period, and I don't have to really, I don't think, work at writing in a what you might call a hard-boiled style, you know, because that would sound silly anyway. But it just comes out as being, you know, a tough, rough period because of when it was. And that was as... the more I learned about it and the more I, you know, the more I delved into it, those things kind of surfaced and I could make use of them.
Mm-hmm. So some things do improve, actually. I think,
Certainly
New York has cleaned up a lot. That's kind of a fascinating background, and people don't realize that and are always shouting about gloom and doom. The city has actually improved substantially since the period.
Yeah, and I know people. There are some people that get all nostalgic. There are some people that get all nostalgic for the old New York, the old Times Square with all the porn, you know, because it's been Disneyfied. And I think that's just a terrible pose to take, because there was a lot of crime that was going on alongside all that. But to get a flavor of it, there's a great shot in, if you search in Google Images, and it's basically you're looking down 42nd from 7th to 8th, and every marquee of all those theaters, you know, the Vic, the American Airlines, the Disney one, are all porn. You know, and now most of those are legit,
yeah.
And some of them are movie houses, and it is pretty amazing. A lot of people have given up on New York as a concept, and so it's not always bad. Things aren't always as bad as people point them at. Make them
it's hard to be nostalgic for that for me. I have to say.
Yeah, you know, I don't think there's any reason to be.
Although it gives you a nice hard-boiled setting, as you said, for your books, which are terrific. And you're a journalist for 30-some years. And, now, how does that influence your style of writing or your writing process? What do you bring to your books that comes out of that background?
Well, I would say, I mean, obviously, you know, what did he do? He made his first protagonist in a series, a journalist, which was a decision I made when I was still working full-time. And, you know, they do say write what you know, though that is a dangerous phrase. You have to be careful with that. But I was working full-time, and so I didn't have the time to research, you know, how a homicide detective works. And I was not a police reporter for much of my career. I know how reporters work. And I did do some police coverage and write-ups, but I was never one like who did it for years and years and years. But it kind of cut out the research that would have been required if I was writing a PI or writing a homicide detective in particular. And the closer you get to a procedural, like with a homicide detective, you know, the audience expects everything. At least I've been told the audience expects everything to be sort of really accurate in that process, and if you don't get it, whereas a journalist has an advantage. He doesn't, you know, even though he covers cops and everything, he doesn't know their whole process. He knows his process, and he knows what they're willing to tell him, but he doesn't know the whole ins and outs of the way they work and the forms they fill out and all that other kind of stuff. Really, that was what, you know, maybe that's the major way that informed it. The way it sort of, I would say, detracted, and I'm going to steal because it's the quickest way to explain it, from Rainbow Rowell, the YA writer, who was a journalist and then became a best-selling writer. She was asked at a recent conference, you know, how did being a journalist, and, you know, same question. And she said there were two major impacts. One of them is when you're a journalist, you know, you write with your newspaper's voice or your wire service's voice. And, of course, if you read the Times or the Wall Street Journal, the Poughkeepsie Journal, you know, that voice is, it's a pretty, to be blunt, a dull voice. You're meant to convey the facts, not, you know, I would say entertain or engage or pull people into a story. And getting away from that voice to a voice for a novelist, a crime fiction writer, took a lot of work. I had a failed manuscript, you know, I completed. It also had a journalist, though a different kind. Got an agent, got 8 rejections, and, you know, I had to work really hard at, I mean, the first big step for me as a writer was sitting there typing away journalistically, telling a crime story wasn't enough. There has to be a voice to the story, and then the voice, of course, then will inform a lot of the other choices you'll make.
So that's a big difference. You get to find your fictional voice. And,
totally.
So now we're coming to a wrap. Just to remind everybody who we've been speaking with again, we've been speaking with Rich Zarodnik, author of A Black Sail, a Coleridge Taylor mystery, which will be published in October, but it's available for pre-order now on Amazon and other sites online, BNN.com and IndieBound, Smashwords, and also will be available in audio. Thank you so much for being here, Rich. Again, that's A Black Sail by Rich Zarodnik. It sounds fantastic. I think readers are just going to love it, and you're going to continue to reap all the readers' and writers' rewards, and I wish you great luck with the book.
Well, thank you for having me. It was great talking about it with you.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much, and so long.